Hi, all. These are generally conversations between adults after the children have left the table. The language can be spicy and the subjects can get saucy. So if you're ready, you are listening to The Southern Fork, a podcast that hosts kitchen chats with some of the most interesting people in the culinary South. I'm your host, Stephanie Burt, and I'm always hungry to learn more. Let's dig in. The Southern Fork is supported by BevCon Charleston. In only 1 year, this industry-only beverage event in Charleston, South Carolina, has become one of the most exciting dates on the calendar for professional bartenders, somms, beverage makers and distributors, and the media that cover the industry of it all. Last year, I learned about twists on a French 75 cocktail, the history of Italian liqueurs, attended a panel about media and PR relationships, and learned about the making of a Southern cocktail book. And that was only in a few hours. BevCon's an intimate setting to learn from one another, share resources, and become inspired to grow. It's an intense learning experience, and I can't wait to be a part of it all again this August 22nd through 24th. For more information, to check out the star-studded presenters lineup, and to purchase your passes, visit bevconchs.com. That's BevConChs.com. There is a dynamic duo of the Southern Heirloom Crop Revival, and they're busy men. So, when I got the chance to interview Glenn Roberts of Anson Mills and Dr. David Shields of the University of South Carolina and the Carolina Gold Rice Foundation, well, I took whatever space I could get, which, in this case, is an echo-filled room. That I didn't realize was on the way to a hotel lobby bathroom. Nevertheless, and despite, these men are so focused on their work and their message that no background noise or interruptions was going to spoil our chat. If you're interested in any discussion involving farming, history, food production, science, how to be a badass chef, or even the damn pursuit of happiness, as Glenn explains here, then you need to listen in. These are two of the thinkers, the movers, the makers of change in food, Southern or otherwise, and the way their minds work together is fascinating.
Welcome to the Southern Fork, you two.
Hey, glad to be here.
Well, honored to be here.
Great. I'm honored to be here. And where is here? Here is in an echoey room in the Vindu Hotel, where you've just educated us all afternoon about the Carolina Gold Rice Foundation. We just had the spring meeting. So that people can know your voices, please introduce yourselves.
David Shields, chair of the foundation.
Glenn Roberts, tractor donkey, and I work with David.
Well, I've got you both on here together because I see you together a lot. I talk to you separately too, but I want to talk about your work together because I think you both fuel each other's fire. Is that true? You like call each other at 2 o'clock in the morning and talk about like rice brands and things like that?
I did that until David got a restraining order.
There are phone calls. We do a lot by email.
Uh-huh.
And
texting,
yeah,
maybe?
Well, I don't text that much.
Okay.
I don't tend to contain my messages in a sentence or so. But there was a time when we were quite regular attendees at lunches.
Mm-hmm.
And early on in our relationship, Glenn would treat me to a lunch at a Columbia restaurant and sit and solve the problems of the world.
And don't forget the delicious beverages.
Oh, delicious beverages, for sure. I think last time we saw each other, Dr. Shields, there was some Madeira involved,
hauling my own Madeira to a boucherie. Because I knew there wouldn't be any.
Shocking, oh I know.
Why like, doesn't everyone have rare social Madeira or something?
I'd like to go back a little bit and just talk about Carolina Gold Rice, since that now is, because of you two, really becoming a household word for chefs and people who are really interested in slow food and whole foods. Where are we now with the Carolina Gold Rice compared to where we were at the beginning? I mean, it's now in commercial production in a lot of ways, right? Very available.
Glenn can tell the story better than I, since he did a lot of the heavy lifting early when it was just being grown by Richard Schulzer, who was one of the members of the board of the foundation. It was virtually a private rice. He did sell it, I guess, an annual auction for his Episcopal church as a fundraiser. And there are stories of chefs coming in bidding up to extraordinary extent the one lot of rice that was available. But Glenn was largely, he and Dr. Merle Shepherd were the really strong movers that actually got Carolina Gold planted in fields that had commercial potential.
Mm-hmm. And I think that some fascination with the rice itself, it's a negative phenomenon. It's Jonathan Green says all the time, the largest human sculpture in the history of the world is the Carolina rice system from prior to the 19th and 20th centuries in that era. And literally millions of acres of wilderness with, 120,000 maybe top at peak rice acreage, hydraulic. But if you stop and think about it, that's all maintained water. That's extraordinary.
Right.
Permanently changed the way things look, created its own light.
Because a lot of people don't realize there's a system of locks.
Yeah.
You have to strategically flood rice. And so with that much acreage, you're creating a floodplain out of marshland, basically, right?
And very much so. And even though Jasper Johns had a tortured existence here, his Ace Basin grays and blue grays and his palette are so recognizable to anybody that's from here. Those are totally synthetic. Those are that material phenomenon tied to human labor is extraordinary. It's bigger than the pyramids, bigger than the Great Wall. And you keep rocking back in awe when you get in the middle of that system and look as far as you can see in any direction, and it's all been managed rice field at one point or another.
Right. Like Marion the Fraser's, like her aerial boutiques that she does, and then you can see that. You can just see that whole space
and so,
geographically.
So the draw to return the crop comes from near impossibility. So the folly of returning something lost always starts with the quixotic challenge of doing something that no one else should, would, or ever could do if they had any sense. Right? That's the truth. Charles Bullock, Tom Hargrove, they shot a movie about trying to recover Carolina Gold Rice.
Mm-hmm.
It turned into a dam engineer instead of a rice guy looking for rice in the Amazon, captured by the FARC. You know, Proof of Life is the name of the movie. They made a movie indirectly about Carolina Gold Rice and its search.
Right.
So the whole thing has that kind of port in a storm, physician who cured the boat thing. But it's all kind of, in the end, unfortunately, hogwash when you do the work.
Right.
Because the work is tactile. The work is logistic. The work's strategic. And if you set out to do it, you just continue to do it until it becomes a reality. It's been kind of a long haul.
It's been a
We're
long 18 haul.
Years in?
Yeah, 18
yeah,
years in. Well, yeah. let's do some of the strategic. Let's talk a little bit of the numbers. What are the numbers like today for Carolina Gold?
I always like to throw a seed in there so that your entire audience can fall asleep. So we're now going to do the exercise and my eyes glaze over Mago. So here's the Mago story about Carolina Gold Rice. It's not how many acres in production, which it's now massive. I have over 2,200 acres myself. Of that, 25% is in research, and research has all kinds of different guises. But we're holding 250,000 pounds of seed in reserve now. And when I actually added that up, I don't know what I did that for you. I did it for somebody just in the last 2 weeks. That's not seed we're going to plant this year. That's seed we're going to plant over the next 4 years. Hurricane Matthew hit us this year, took out our ratoon crops. That's the second crop. Took out all of our purple K beans, just ripped up the coast and did everything. So that's here. In Texas in 2015 and here in 2015, we had a series of floods. Up until then, we had 3 years of rice seed. Mm-hmm. So when you ask how many acres of rice, it's not the production acres that are significant to your audience, especially if they cook.
Right.
What you want is biosecurity, because if you have a menu, you want the ingredient to be there. So it's how are the reserves, and then what kind of acreage is that feeding? It's up over 6,000 now, maybe 7.
Wow. Well, now we have the next generation. And just to give a little bit, you might know Dr. Shields' voice from The Mind of the Chef, those little videos. You did one on the watermelon. And
the watermelon.
Those are great, by the way. Those are super great. And there was another one that was on like onion or garlic or turnip or something like
that. Yes, I've done a number of those for Mind of a Chef, including one on the Sauerkraut King.
That's
New
right.
York, one of the great old culinary clubs.
Which, is that Sandra Katz's mother?
So the watermelon, we've talked about the Bradford watermelon a lot, at least in my part of the world. We have the African runner peanut. We have Jimmy Red Corn. This feels like the children of this Carolina gold rice crazy path that you're
on. When Glenn first sort of enlisted me into the effort to bring back Carolina gold, he quite explicitly said
he gave you a bottle of Madeira and pointed a gun.
Yeah, you know,
we were gnawing on a loaf of rice bread in the parking lot. It wasn't very austere or entitled or anything or monumental, but it was good rice bread.
Yeah,
he said, you know, I want to bring back the entire Low Country cuisine, the rice kitchen, and that means bringing back the entire growing system, co-crops, provision crops, rotation crops, all the crops. So what we did was we actually did research into them and found out what were the most important enduring ingredients for a long period of time. We had a list, and so it was never sort of like ethnobotanical serendipity, you know. A lot when you read about the Seed Savers Exchange, you hear about some guy who stumbles across a bean in the Appalachian. This is the Epting family bean, you know. It tastes so wonderful and things like that. But, you know, it's just the Epting family that ever ate it.
They did have Seed Savers on CBS Sunday Morning, this Sunday morning.
Well, there are a lot of them. But we were interested in things that had broad, enduring, central places, both the farm and on the table. And so we took a look at, you know, what were the cowpeas? What were the other grains? We know pretty much the entire system now. Mm-hmm. And the question was just hunting down the ingredients. And today when we introduced the American Hill rice, this red bearded upland rice that used to be grown from the south, that came from West Africa, but ceased being grown sometime in the last part of the 19th century, and we found it in Trinidad.
Mm-hmm.
That's a kind of indication of just
where it goes.
Yeah, how much you have to think. Not just restricted to the region, but know the history, know the trade lines, the transits, the way empires work.
Yeah, there was a lot of discussion about the War of 1812 today. I mean, you need to know, just like you're saying, you know the history. But I'd love for you both of you to, one of you to take one of each of these things. I have this question a lot as a food writer, especially somebody who frankly cheats a lot and just watches what you do and writes about it.
That's not cheating.
So I basically am like, how do I what are they doing? Oh, that's interesting. I'll write about that. So I'm always like, what are you up to? What's that? Oh, peanuts. Great. I'll write about peanuts. So it's really easy, you know.
Some people call it appropriation. Other people call it inspiration.
That's right. Okay? So I do know from this that it's really, I get this question a lot. Why does this matter? If this stuff went away, why do we need to bring it back? Besides just the diversity of the food shed and that kind of thing, there are really mainly two reasons. One is the food, the way it tastes. Another is the environment, right?
Right.
And how they're grown. And so can we talk a little bit about each one of those?
Okay. Let's talk about flavor. And this is something where Glenn and I really strongly agree. Every biological entity is hardwired to recognize what is both edible and nutritious in its environment, whether it's a paramecium, a bird, a primate, or human beings.
Mm-hmm.
So flavor is the way you know what is good for you. And for generations, the people who grew food used their own taste buds in the guiding of how they would select seed for the next generation.
Mm-hmm.
So all of these carefully sculpted old varieties of grains were bred for flavor. And they were usually prepared in a pretty straightforward way, like a porridge or something,
mm-hmm.
so you could get the intrinsic flavor quick.
Right. Like Schaumbrock makes the Carolina ice cream or the Charleston ice cream, serves it at Husk and McCrady's. And that's just rice with butter and salt.
Right.
I mean, there's a few other things to it, but it's in its beautiful, plain form.
So Glenn, you know, this was part of his instruction to me. He said these things that have been developed by hundreds of generations of humans and thousands of plant generations, they have a name. They're called land races.
Mm-hmm.
That's the stuff we have to protect first.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been a kind of almost, I guess it's a religious conviction.
Totally. The nuances are endless, but the most compelling part of the canon of cuisine and place-based identity and those things we keep hearing that sound so vaulted and stuff, a good example is if you can line up the best palates in the United States and lay stuff in front of them and go, okay, which one do you like? And you're doing a blind tasting. Everybody knows what that is.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
if it tastes better and it's modern food, it's not necessarily more nutritious. But if it happens to be pre-industrial food and it tastes better, the flavor profile is an indication of nutrition. So that's another iteration of what David just said. So the nuances that sort of extend what David's speaking about, all these land races have relationships, and depending on where you are on the planet at any time, the relationships can change, and the relationships can get extremely complex, or they can become very, very simple. And it has to do with biosecurity
mm-hmm.
and human security. And the pursuit of happiness jumps right into my mind because Jefferson's trying to encapsulate whatever that is in that silly statement, because
mm-hmm.
it really doesn't mean a whole lot unless you're thinking, well, the pursuit of happiness would be, can I not starve next year?
Mm-hmm.
That's a pretty big pursuit. What people don't think about in these systems is all of our modern food is based on the genetics of all these old things. And we got to a point where we were looking at electron microscopes and doing digital analysis to the point where we've got now 4, 5, 6 generations of geneticists that just don't go out in the field, period.
Wow.
They're on computer deck. And they've got enough material in the seed banks to play games with, just pushing numbers and coming up with a new food.
Right.
I think Francis's best statement in this session, and this is Francis Morian from Trinidad, the ethnobotanist, said that one of the reactions to modern rice in Trinidad right now is something called plastic rice.
Right.
Right?
Right.
I thought that was, one, hilarious, two, horrifying.
Right.
Because
can believe that it's plastic.
I could, even though I know that's not exactly what he meant.
Right.
I can believe it because wildlife, they don't like eating the modern rices.
Right.
Everybody out there, the largest rice production in the United States is for wealth, for hunting. Mm-hmm. It's not really for human food.
Right.
All this massive acreage we have, they're hunting ducks and
right.
things like that.
Right, of right? course.
And ducks don't like modern rice. Mm-hmm. And so you see some evidence in the wild kingdom of what Francis was referring to as plastic. I love the term, by the way. I've never heard that before. Have you?
No.
Only
the fact that the Chinese are supposed to be manufacturing. That would be interesting.
I'm sure that this is going to be a conversation with Trump's stuff at Mar-a-Lago today, don't you think?
He's going to listen right in.
Yeah,
he's
going to listen right in. Hey, let's talk about that plastic rice. So the reality is, those systems that put those plants together that makes the tilth right, that makes the highest nutrition and the best flavor,
mm-hmm.
those are a cuisine. That was the basis of all of this, that there are bodies of cuisine. And if you actually move back, because I wasn't smart enough to do it, but David is, move back and look at the entire plant system, you start picking up the direction of the cuisine because it's always changing. So looking at the direction of cuisine in that system, it was interrupted about 1850, 1900, 1950. Pick your century, half century. We know it's been gone since 1950.
Right.
Collapsing. And Francis's scary statement here is in Trinidad, that hill rices are unwinding. And in Africa, that same culture in Africa, which was the pervasive rice culture 250 years ago, is now moving at the speed of light into extinction. Those are the flavor axioms. Those are the genetic and health axioms. Those are the rices that we use to breed new things for the future of food, for biosecurity, so that we can pursue happiness. And no one seems to want to put that together.
Right.
Because you have to talk about genetics and seed. And my God, if you're at a bar on a Saturday night, I can't wait to sit around and talk about genetics. And we should go get Dr. Prudeman from NYU over here right now and talk about genetics. I actually like doing that, which is why my wife sometimes gets upset with me,
mm-hmm.
right? And David has the mind of a geneticist because he has the mind of everything.
Yes, he does.
Me, I'm on a tractor at 2 miles an hour. Genetics is just fine. Right?
Well,
that was an interesting answer, wasn't
that
it?
That was an interesting answer. I was like, all right, like, how do I segue from that? But really, just to recap, it's the idea of we're building on something that we're losing.
Yeah.
So we've built so far, so many generations, it's almost like a house of cards. If we bump that in any way, we're not going to have the foundation to rebuild it.
Yeah. This already happened. Happened in 1970 with maize here in America. They narrowed the genetics for breeding to the point at which when it started to collapse, we almost lost our corn system completely. At that point, it was catastrophic, and it was such a scare that here, almost a half century in, mm-hmm. we're still thinking about that.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't experience that in wheat, although this year we've planted the least winter wheat in the history of America since 1900.
Mm-hmm.
And we have the least amount of wheat acres in the ground in this country since 1850, aggregate total.
Wow.
It's frightening what's out there. This is in the Wall Street Journal, February 14th, Valentine's Day. Right? Nice, beautiful report to tell us how much
we
should
be
concerned.
By the way, Glenn Roberts is not driving his mind of a tractor at 2 miles an hour.
Mind of a tractor. Great. Not mind of a chef.
No, mind of
Great
a tractor.
Idea.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So all of that comes down to the plate, comes down to where we are, we're cultivating, we're working. I mean, and what we sat in today was really like a celebrity slow food situation to me. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot of, like, that's where the work gets done. It's strange. It's big mind. It's going in and, like, figuring out what the yield is and what the acreage is. All that stuff that isn't sexy. So no one turns it off. Let's talk about some sexy stuff here. Let's talk about, like, some of the great things that are now being made with some of the stuff that you've brought back. And then also, too, the arc of taste folds into this. And right. So you've been instrumental, Dr. Shields, pushing some of this stuff. So it's like Glenn and you have these secret chats in parking lots eating rice bread. Then suddenly something happens. I mean, not secret like you're hiding, but secret like no one cares. And then suddenly something lands on the Arc of Taste, you know, and then you post it on Facebook and 400 people comment on lettuce, which is more people interested in lettuce than I've ever seen in my whole life. And then, you know, then we have a whole dinner about lettuce and everybody comes and we try different lettuces. But it's basically kind of what happens in a way, right? It's all based on people. But, I mean, it's based on people getting interested in this right. variety.
Yes.
I know we didn't do lettuce. We did, rye. Seashore rye. That was interesting and sexy. Lots of bread. Yeah, I love that.
Lots of alcohol and beverage. You have to realize that unless there is that taste or flavor, no one's going to show up to dinner.
That's right.
And I think one of the things which is interesting is, you know, Glenn made this remark, if you bring in the best palates in the nation, but that's exactly what's happened. The people who desired this the most, you know, after Alice Waters reoriented the focus on the quality of the vegetable in the late 20th century, it's chefs, and the chefs desire flavor because their livelihoods depend upon it.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can put out a bowl of fresh milled maize or anything in front of them, they don't have to taste it. They can smell it. And they've smelled enough stuff in their life and tasted enough stuff so that their response is almost instantaneous.
Mm-hmm. You know?
Exactly.
Well, and when we get back to that flavor being the pre-industrial being the nutrition, I mean, my friend Chris Wilkins, hey, Chris, he talks all the time about he gets really passionate about bread being healthy and that's great for you because the grains that he makes his bread with are healthy and they have a lot more vitamins. They're not something to stay away from. A low-carb diet is not what Chris wants as a chef and a baker, and it's not what his body wants either. He cooks this nutritious stuff. So it's flavor and nutrition, but the chefs are really looking at the flavor.
Right. One of the things too, you know, you have to realize that sometimes the tides of aesthetics in terms of taste run against you, or the tides of convenience sometimes turn against you.
Sauerkraut king at all.
Well, yeah,
sauerkraut will never go out.
I was actually thinking about the problem of the Bradford watermelon actually surfaced. And, you know, we're in the age where people are buying seedless refrigerator melons that are about, you know, a foot across. And here was this ancient, superb tasting watermelon that was 40 pounds and chock full of seeds. And, you know, there was a certain part of the population who could lift one out of the produce bin into their grocery cart.
Well, the grocery cart wasn't big enough. Yeah.
That is true.
That's true.
Right.
So, those little grocery carts they have now.
I love those.
Those are baby grocery carts.
I love
for
them.
Baby watermelon.
So one of the things that...
I put 3 beets in there. And I'm like, woo, time to check out.
So one of the things you have to do is, you know, think how the taste or flavor can be framed in a way where there is a kind of consumer demand. And one of the things that we did, we did the research into what watermelons were used for that they aren't used for now. And on the very first harvest, Glenn took his sorghum evaporator and we were all made watermelon molasses.
Please note, Glenn Roberts has a sorghum evaporator. Okay, move
I'm
on.
Very cool. Portable. Not everybody has one of those.
Portable.
A two-car garage with enough room for a sorghum evaporator. That's when you know.
The pursuit of happiness is in force.
Yeah.
So we took it out into the field, and Glenn and Nat Bradford. And
we all sweat to death. It was 106, and the thing was running at 250 degrees at the top and 400 and something underneath. It was really sweet. David put up with the heat better than anyone else out there, and Nat's a multi-generation legacy farmer. I was dying.
Mm-hmm.
I'm supposed to know how to do this, and I'm a wimp. I couldn't do it.
But basically, you were salesman. You said, okay, we want to do this. And we've got to show you some ways you can use the watermelon. Basically.
Another way to say that, it's his fault.
Yeah.
That grown human beings were out on a day when it was over 100 degrees with a 450 degree cooking furnace hauling watermelons by hand and juicing them, then evaporating the syrup. Yep. It's his fault.
But at the end of the day, when you taste the watermelon syrup, it was a taste that was splendid and nothing like it had been tasted in decades.
And that speaks to where chefs live, and we've been through so many iterations. I'm reminded that the latest food in the New York Times title, The Hippies Won the Plate, which I like the trope, but it's so silly because I was around with hippies and I wasn't fond of their food at all because I was raised in a French kitchen and that's not the way we ate, hippie or not. I'm not sure what it means by that. I think they're just talking about ingredients. But if you speak in chef vision, then your ultimate is the visual palette and your other ultimate is the amount of transformations you can bring to a food without manipulating it into a negative area. That's a big, long mishmash of the first step would be concentration, watermelon syrup. The second step is all of them increase nutrition, by the way. This takes watermelons, which may or may not be medicine, and turn them into medicine. And we don't fuse the pharmacopoeia like so many cultures do with the herbal here. It's bifurcated. So so much of the old stuff was as important medicinally. And now we're thinking about that. And that was always like, oh, I wear Birkenstocks and I'm into holistic medicine. And that's not what I'm speaking of. I think the brute force statement for fusing the pharmacopoeia with the herbal would be that rice was the number one staple shipped on any whalers, and there were 3,000 plus whalers. It was the number one staple on board because it was seen as important as medicine as a food. So it was more than wheat, more than corn, more than anything else as a provision. And that's all tied to some pretty powerful things. The other thing that would be involved is what rice, what's the flavor, how do you keep people interested, and why would you be doing it, and why those transformative things can happen, because you can do all the five great transformations to any food, and then the sixth one is the one David brought up, which is concentration, right? The other five nixed them all, like tacos and things like that, masa, and parching, and all these things compound nutrition impact on human systems. And they also compound
flavors.
They make
the vitamins more bioavailable to the body.
That's... So you keep going through ferments. You got two kinds of ferments. You go through just on and on. And if you stop and parse these things, it becomes an infinite progression of increasing flavor combinations. And chefs live and die by playing that ping pong, which is a five-dimensional ping pong, actually. And it becomes the visual palette. And the best chefs I've worked with, starting with Keller, Barber, and the rest of them, when they're coming to work, they're actually thinking about how the flavors look, not how they sense in a sensory fashion an aroma or taste. They're thinking about how the flavors look. It's actually a set of visions, right?
That they're writing music.
It's like music. Right. Exactly. A lot of people that I know who are great musicians talk like that. By the way, I'm sitting next to one. And his wife as well. And his son as well. And that seems to be something that's very closely allied, that thinking. Music is in the background.
Well, that's
Glenn was a musician as well.
Yeah, I played the trash can. No.
Well, I play the Yeti mic.
Right.
So there it is. And
very well done.
If people want to learn more, I'm going to continue learning more because these two men inspire me and my work, and I've made that quite clear. They make actually my work pretty easy. You can go to thesouthernfork.com. We're going to have some links to their work. I'm going to try to figure out what to link to because there's a lot that I can, from Anson Mills, the Carolina Gold Rice Foundation, to David Chill's work, to his Mind of a Chef videos. I mean, I don't even know what I'm going to link to. There's all kinds of things. And we're not going to even talk about your gymnastics or your the gymnastics book. We can't even go there. It's a whole new subject.
We could talk about opera.
Yes.
Daguerreotype. Yeah. Drama posters. Is it the seven? Six senses?
No, I do five.
Five senses. Five. You don't do the other ones? Okay.
Well, And these two guys should point out, they should prove to you that anytime you say that you don't have time to do something, not true. Just not true. Busiest people I know got time to sit here for 25 minutes and talk to me about seeds. So thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you.
Truth to power.
You've been listening to The Southern Fork. I can't wait to bring you more culinary conversations, but in the meantime, I have one question. Are you going to eat all that?